from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio, this is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. In her new novel, A Kind of Freedom, Bay Area author Margaret Wilkerson Sexton explores the three-generation-long descent into poverty of an upper-middle-class black family in New Orleans. She'll join us in the studio. Then at 10:30, two Native American judges are taking a hands-on approach with the people coming through their courtrooms, helping them with drug rehab, or even offering to be their guardians.
I'm in a position to go, let's help you on these things. Let us help you. Let us help you. We will stick with it until we resolve it.
They're the subject of a new documentary called Tribal Justice. Join us next after the news. Welcome to Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. Bay Area author Margaret Wilkerson Sexton joins us in studio to discuss her debut novel, A Kind of Freedom, which explores the long descent into poverty of three generations of an upper-middle-class black family in Louisiana, from World War II to post-Katrina. The Huffington Post, recommending A Kind of Freedom in its summer reading list, praises Wilkerson Sexton's novel for, quote, subtly laying bare the ever-present societal forces at work to undermine black success and family. She was born in New Orleans and studied creative writing at Dartmouth. She earned a law degree from UC Berkeley, and we're going to discuss how her legal experience and childhood in New Orleans informs her writing and discuss her novel. And welcome, Margaret Wilkerson Sexton.
Thank you. I'm happy to be here.
Well, happy to have you here. And the first question I have to ask you is, are you related to Isabel Wilkerson?
No, I wish. I wish I was related to Isabel Wilkerson. I love the book.
She's the author of The Warmth of Other Suns, which we featured on Forum, which is a splendid book.
Oh, absolutely.
I thought, boy, this must be some family if there is.
I know.
Let's talk about, first, your, well, growth into being a novelist. I mentioned that you have a UC Berkeley law degree, and you worked a year actually at Google, I understand, and were in the Dominican Republic on a fellowship. What made you become a novelist?
Well, I always wanted to be a writer since about the age of, I would say, 9. My father read this poem I wrote for a class, and He really thought it was ahead of its time, and he just thought it was amazing, and he talked it up, and I thought, okay, well, if writing...
Fathers are wont to do this.
Of course. But I thought, if writing is going to earn this kind of praise, then, you know, I that's what I'll do. And then I go back and read the poem a few years later, or maybe a decade later, and it's a very basic. I mean, I don't know what he saw in it, but it definitely set the path for me to look into that field. And I've always liked to read, and so it was something I always wanted to do. But then, you know, you graduate from college and you start to think about the reality of life and how you'll make money, and I wasn't sure what my path to writing would be, so I decided to go to law school. And I thought, well, this will be good training for whatever I decide to do. And, you know, it's not that it will preclude me from writing later. So I went, and then you go to law school. And then I sort of got on the track that develops when you go to law school. Where you know, you have firms coming to interview, and it's hard to say no to the firms. And so I did that, and I just wasn't happy. So I decided to take a step back and think about what I really wanted to do. And I just went right back to the first dream I ever had, which was to write.
But not a poet, a novelist. Why a novelist?
Well, I always wanted to write stories, but I think in college, where I majored in poetry, it was kind of a circumstantial thing. Actually, it wasn't that I was more attracted to poetry. It was just kind of, that's what I was known to be good at, because it was just shorter form and I had more experience in it earlier in my life. So I just decided to stay with that familiarity. But I always wanted to write stories, and I always thought that's what I would do ultimately.
Well, you've certainly done it, and
with
a lot of originality, I might add, in terms of a large canvas here. I mean, we're talking about many years, and we're talking about a number of generations, but also the setting is key, and that's your roots, New Orleans, where a lot of people, I was thinking in reading your book of Streetcar Named Desire, which is set there, you know, and there's this feeling that blacks and whites actually could live together, and very different than the Deep South, and obviously Mississippi, Alabama, even Virginia, as we found out. Blacks were doing okay in the 30s and 40s, in fact, to a great extent, and that's what you bring into focus.
Well, some of them were. I mean, I think especially in New Orleans, there was a certain subset of society, of black society, that was doing okay, and they were educated. And so that's the aspect of the city at that time that I wanted to delve into, partly because my family is anchored in that history, and I wanted to bring that out. And then I also wanted to touch upon the degree to which that can change, even though you wouldn't expect that change, because in many ways, in our society, we've grown so much. You know, we've had a black president, and Jim Crow is no longer in place, and we've had so many strides. But having said that, we still have replacements, Jim Crow replacements that are in place right now that are preventing black people from living optimal lives and from really tapping into the freedom that was promised with the emancipation of slavery. And so I wanted to get into the degree to which you can move so far in some ways, but also decline in others.
And decline in part because even though Jim Crow's abolished, the shadow of slavery and the prison system seem to be the two major impediments as you see things. Yeah.
Right. I would say the prison system, and I would say along with that, the treatment of the war on drugs, which is what I wanted to touch upon in the second part of the book. So the first part deals with Jim Crow in the 40s. The second part deals with the way the crack epidemic was mishandled in the 80s. And then the third part is more of a present post-Katrina time where we're looking at the mass incarceration of black men is my focus, but it's black people really. And so, yeah, those, when I
looked, you had that structure in mind? I mean, what you just described from the beginning?
Yes. I didn't know what would be the second part. I knew about mass incarceration as an issue, and I knew about Jim Crow, and I wanted to have those as bookends, but I thought, what happened along the way to kind of create what we're seeing now in my generation? And of course, a lot of that is just systemic, and it's just, you know, in the 80s because of economic inequality and hypersegregation in cities, we saw a lot of people descend into crack use, and we also saw the country respond with criminalization instead of with care and compassion and help. So you see generations that have just been taken from, you see a generation that's just been taken from families, black men in particular, and that's what happens in the book. The father figure in the second section is removed from the home, and then his son, you know, is also involved in the criminal justice system decades later.
And we're talking again, if you've just joined us, with Bay Area novelist Margaret Wilkerson Sexton, who has a novel out called A Kind of Freedom. And freedom underlies a lot of the themes in your novel. I couldn't help noticing that you've got early on a quote of Edward P. Jones that sort of makes it way into your title. It's from all of Anne Hager's Children, which I think we featured on Forum many years ago.
Oh, is that right? Wow. Yeah.
But the idea that always there's a struggle that is ongoing, despite maybe ascent into the black bourgeoisie or upper echelons in terms of income and everything, there's always that sense of freedom lurking and not really being there, as Baldwin put it.
Right, exactly. And that's what I wanted to get at with the title. I imagine after slavery there was a hope and a delusional hope. It's turned out that freedom would equal what slaves must have dreamed it would mean, what it meant for whites. And it just seems like throughout the years there have been systems put in place to preempt that from ever being fruitful, completely fruitful.
This is a really kind of a moral book about not only freedom but hope. I mean, I think. You know, there's a lot that's sad in your book, and some of the stories really are ones that we can feel sad about, but hope comes through.
Oh, good. I wanted it to. I even went back several times to to tinker with the ending because I thought, well, I want to end with hope because I'm hopeful about this situation, and that's one of the reasons I decided to end with the wedding.
And you also have to tinker a bit with not having male stereotypes here.
I did, and I was going to have the male character, the Renard character, turn out to be not so great of a husband, and I decided, why do that? I mean, there are other struggling men in this novel, and so I want to make sure that there's at least one. I mean, in my life, there are many, many amazing Black males that I look up to, and that's the community I'm aware of. But in this book, I wanted to make sure there was at least one, you know, so that people could leave it thinking it's been a relatively wide spectrum of Black life that they've been exposed to.
And I'm sure you're well aware of the fact that there was, for quite some time, a good deal of almost strong reaction is the way I would best characterize it against some of the Black women novelists like Alice Walker and Toni Morrison, who were portraying men in what was at least deemed to be a very negative way, mostly.
I remember it with The Color Purple, and I love the book, and I didn't think about
Although he changes, actually.
Yeah, that's true. I remember it with that. I mean, it's hard because as a writer, you want to write about your experience and you want to write the story that calls for you to write it. But then you also have to be cognizant of the fact that you're representing a group. And especially, you know, actually, this opens up another point, like especially Black writers, because there are fewer. And so you have to be cognizant of the fact that you're disclosing a lot about a group of society, and your readers may not be exposed to that group as widely as you are. So you have to be cognizant of the fact that this may be the only exposure they get, and you want to make sure you're representing it, you know, in a fair way.
You're feeling the weight of all that as a novelist.
I do. I think about it. I think about it. And as I was writing it, I would talk with people about, you know, I had early readers and I would ask them, you know, is this okay? And I still worry about it, even now that it's out.
Again, the novel we're talking about is A Kind of Freedom. And we want to hear perhaps your thoughts and have you join this conversation. I want to give you an opportunity to do that. If you have a question or a comment for our guest, you can join us now. Our toll-free number is 866-733-6786. It's a half-hour segment, so if you'd like to join us, please do so now. Again, it's 866-733-6786, or email us, forum@kqed.org, or go right to our website, kqed.org/forum, and click on the segment, or tweet us. Our Twitter handle is @KQEDForum. A number of ways you can participate in the program, and we'd like to hear from you, and indeed, feel free to join us. You know, you mentioned Renard, and early on, that character who meets Evelyn, the Creole woman, she has to choose kind of between class and love. I mean, class plays an important role here. And as you see it, particularly in this New Orleans racial world that you're creating for us, transgenerational world of families, class may be as much involved in terms of how we understand these lives as race itself.
Yeah, I would agree with that. I think she definitely had to choose between class and love. But one of my readers said that it was interesting because throughout the book, she kept thinking wondering if I was trying to pinpoint the way things ended up happening within their family on the fact that she had chosen to marry someone beneath her class wise. And the answer to that is no. She had to choose between class and love, but I think she made the right decision. And I think that I think if she had chosen someone in her own class, she still would have been vulnerable to the factors that contributed to her own family's socioeconomic decline because of the fact that she's Black in the 40s. And we know what approached her. We know, as you know, as inhabitants of 2017, we know what came between the 40s and this current time, and it was difficult and it was challenging for Black people.
This is a novel about three generations. It covers 70 years, and it takes us into really the lives and also the families that are focused upon here. You know, there used to be this kind of common wisdom that Black families were not really like nuclear families. They were extended families, brothers, sisters, and so forth, more almost of a kind of tribal identity as opposed to the traditional nuclear family. But these are more traditional nuclear families.
Oh, I didn't know. I didn't know about that perception of do you mean like the way there's a perception of in other countries that people will have like extended families living with them? Or what do you mean by that?
No, I mean that I'm thinking about black sociologists like Franklin mm-hmm. Frazier, who actually uh-huh. wrote, you know, Black Bourgeoisie and everything. Uh-huh. And talk about how families were more extended. Everybody was your cousin or, you know, in a sense of not the tight nuclear family, you know.
Yeah. So it's larger.
It's larger.
It includes
right,
yeah. more. And this family is nuclear. Yeah, I didn't think about that. You're right. That this family is more of a traditional one in the way we think about it. It's they don't have a lot of extended family, you know, mingling in their lives in this book. It's just, you know, it's the parents and the two sisters and the brother in the first generation, and then and in Jackie's generation, it's her husband and her child. And then, of course, later, you know, the husband is removed from the family, and it's the mother and the son.
I'm going to read a comment by a listener named Daniel who says, your guest commented that she doesn't know what her father saw in her original poetry that inspired him. When she becomes a parent, she'll realize that the unconditional support of our children's dreams is what helps them to achieve their dreams, regardless of the tortuous path they take to get there.
Oh, no, I understand. I have, you know, I actually have three children. And so I see it. You know, I have all these ideas for what my own kids will be.
But there's a thin line sometimes. You know, sometimes yeah. you can overpraise your kid and think, I'm giving them inflated notions of themselves.
I know. So, yeah, I bet it could have gone either way with my dad's reception of that poem. You know, I bet it could have gone either way. But he saw something. I think he saw, yeah, he obviously saw something.
Helped shape who you are. And let's go to our callers. We begin, Dan, with you. Dan, you're on.
Yes, good morning. I'm wondering what your guest thinks of where we are in history now and when we're going to get to, anytime soon, a time when the white people of this continent will share the bounty with the non-white people, as said in that movie Lincoln, you know, where Tommy Lee Jones' character says that. And, you know, recent events, we had a black president, now we have what some people call the white lash. I'm hopeful, but cautious. I was wondering what your opinion is.
Well, I think I would characterize the current time period as the one that I referenced in the book. TC's section takes place in 2010. I don't think we're anywhere different from there, except you're right. We do have a new president, but I think we're still in many ways we're not. In many ways, we. Are not so far from the Jim Crow period because we have this system of mass incarceration that's removing black people and particularly black men from homes. And we also have a system that we know disproportionately targets black men in terms of even arresting them and beginning the sentencing process. So I think in those ways, we still have very similar restrictions. And you know, we did have a black president and that's great. But I do think that created a response that we've seen. I mean, we've seen it over the weekend. And I think in some ways it was great to have a black president. It definitely moved us forward and that's unequivocal. But in some ways it also unleashed a fury in some communities that we're seeing now and that appear to be taking us backwards.
And let me thank the caller. That's Dan. You can join us at our toll-free number. It's 866-733-6786. We'll get John on next. John, welcome.
Hello?
Yeah, hi, John.
Hi. I have a question. I had recently just read a couple of plays that related to the black experience in America. I'd reread Raisin in the Sun. And then recently after that, I read a play by Katari Holly, who had written To the Mountaintop. And it was a remake, I guess, of A Raisin in the Sun. And one of the interesting things about it was that with A Raisin in the Sun, it felt like that while there was a lot of social racism that was going on, you know, it was a time when you were to the back of the bus or shortly after that. In Katari Holly's play, it seemed like there was much more violence, much more drugs, much more of a disintegration of, like, economic means of supporting your family, with less of the overt racism of you have to drink from a different water fountain or anything like that, or go to a separate school. And it was a place filled with like drugs and gangs and violence, all circled around Raisin in the Sun. I guess I'm curious, in your research for your book, did you kind of find that to be true? And did you see what kind of factors were accounting for that?
Yeah, that's a really good question. I think you're right. In the time period where Raisin in the Sun was set, we were seeing more overt signs of racism. You know, Jim Crow examples like the one you gave, and
housing discrimination, which is really what Raising the Sun is all about.
Right. But I think what we're seeing now with drugs and violence and all that you mentioned is just actually an echo of housing discrimination that never went away. There's still highly hyper-segregated areas, especially in cities, that are removing resources from Black communities. And so it's leaving them in situations where they're more exposed to drugs, violence, et cetera. Also, I think that we're finding that we know statistically that Blacks are not necessarily doing drugs more than any other group, but are being targeted as drug users, are being investigated, arrested, and sentenced disproportionately to other groups for use of drugs and also for violence.
Well, you're right about the crack epidemic, and we just did a program on the opioid epidemic, and the difference has to do, to a great extent, with race. I mean, in terms of punishment particularly.
Right, the criminalization of one drug versus the other. There seems to be a great deal more compassion here for the opioid addiction, and that's justified and that's fair. There should be, but I'm saying, you know, it would have been nice if the crack epidemic had been treated in the same way, and instead of creating hyperbolic caricatures of crack users and criminalizing them and removing them from homes.
Here's Annie. Annie, join us.
Oh, hey, Margaret. I wanted to know what your process was for writing your book, especially being a mom with three kids. There's a book in me, too, and I've been trying to get it started, but I just wanted to know what your recommendations are.
Let's see. I had my kids are in school until 12. And before that, I had a sitter about 10 to 15 hours a week. And I would just try to write when they were napping or when the sitter was there. I started before I had them. So I had momentum. But even, you know, once they were here, most of the work was done once they were here. And I just tried to work while they were napping or while they were otherwise occupied. And it was always little bits. It was always little bursts and bits and pieces here and there. I never felt like I could sit a full day, of course. But it was still, you know, over time that adds up. That's what I would say. Be patient, because over time, a page here, a page there will add up to a book.
Margaret Wilkerson Sexton, her book is A Kind of Freedom. Congratulations on the
book.
Thank
you.
Thank you so much for joining us. Natalie Bazile, author of Queen Sugar, says, vividly imagined, boldly told, this is a book of our time, a fierce and courageous debut. When we return, we're going to talk about tribal justice, about actually courtrooms that involve members of tribes appearing, well, before fellow members, and the distribution of justice in that context. Stay tuned for that. It's up ahead. Thank you for joining us on Forum this morning. I'm Michael Krasny.